And I'm glad to welcome Gianluca Varesco, who is going to talk to us about modern security features for web apps. And the floor is yours.
Thank you very much. And hi. So, good afternoon, everyone. Glad to be here with you. Just as a background, before we move forward, I'm Gianluca. I've spent the last 20 years both in the public and private sector, doing cyber, mostly. And I got interested over the last year also to web app security and everything that actually entails. How can we make the web better from a security standpoint? So happy to be here today with you. Now, today I'm going to try to answer this question that I know it's what actually keeps everybody awake at night. That is, how can we actually make the web, how can we fix the web not to be a scary place? Now, if I actually had to summarize where we are from a security standpoint in a single slide, but I'll try to go beyond that, is we have three main pillars that I love to call actually the three capital sins that are fundamentally encryption, injection, and a fundamental isolation. When it comes to encryption, of course, and isolation, I'm referring to the lack of it. If you actually want to shake the hand of whoever is actually sitting next to you, I think we did a very good job on the encryption side over the last years, so congrats, everyone. On the injection side, there's still a lot to do in there, but things are getting better. And on the isolation side, so today the talk is going to be covering both the injection and the isolation part of it. Now, when we talk about injection, we start from the simplest of our nightmare, trusted scripting. And I'm pretty sure you're all familiar with trusted scripting and actually countless similar approaches and similar patterns that you might have seen when responding to incidents on your company, working on projects with other peers. And fundamentally, we had to always address injections from a standpoint on how can we mitigate multiple classes of vulnerabilities in there. So cross-site scripting being our like entry point in there. Isolation here is pretty interesting also, because when you think about isolation, when you think about how can we fundamentally try to respond to new classes of flows, we had microarchitectural issues. You might recall SPECT meltdown, the subsequent patches that got applied, how old your Linux kernel and your Linux machines became slower at some point in time. It required also an additional set of patches. And fundamentally in here, isolation is pretty interesting because we might be talking about same site isolation, same origin isolation, and several other type of isolation that we're going to be covering today. Now, it all actually started, if you make a request to any page out there, you can see an example in here. We can split the request between three main areas that I wanted to cover today. Content security policy and trusted types that we're going to be covering today, the two headers you see up there. Content security policy with the goal of blocking third-party app scripts from execution. And the third part of it that is pretty interesting is how do we make isolation working to address cross-site request forgery, XSSI, and several other type of classes of vulnerabilities that we might be wanting to address with fetch metadata headers and some other things that I will be going through today. Now, let's go into the isolation mechanism because I think we have a lot to unpack in here. Now, why do we even bother on isolation? Isolation is pretty interesting because we might have isolation when we consider attacking Windows, and we will see what Windows means, and when we see attacking on resources. Now, it's pretty interesting to see how you can do cross-site search and, in general, leaking information from a given tab, from a given window of your browser. And that we want to address, actually, with how not to leak information, how not to attack, how actually to mitigate attacks at the resources level. And so the first things that I want you to start with is, like we said, we might have three scenarios, actually, to address. The same origin site, the same site in here, and actually the cross site. Same origin, as you can imagine, same URL, same path. I mean, different path on the same URL, but the schema is actually the same. Same site with potentially the same schema and actually registrable domains. What's interesting in here that we're going to be also addressing today is actually how cross site might come handy, and how we mitigate all the three. And what that actually does, origins versus sites, has to be along. Now, when we consider isolation for resources, there's a very nice thing. How many of you have deployed, for instance, fetch metadata request headers across your applications? No one. One, two, three, four. Good. You're the best. So what's interesting in here is actually that we always consider ourselves to be in charge of taking decisions, granting decision to the request, granting decision to the clients, but what if actually we make the server itself make those security decisions on our behalf? What if, based on the source, based on the context of each HTTP request, we can consider, for instance, which website generates the request, for instance? What request mode, denoting the type, and also anything with the type of request? And what if we can also consider the destination in there? What type of data are we talking about? What if we can instrument each of those requests to perform and behave differently across HTTP requests that we're going to be considering as such? Let's have a look at, for instance, this example where when we call this URL, like this foo JSON at site.example, we are fundamentally setting three headers: sacfetch site, sacfetch mode, and actually the destination in there. Here we're starting to set to allow the same origin. Here we're starting to consider also our QRS policy, or course policy, if you allow so. And then we're also defining what to do with the destination in there. Now let's consider, for instance, something where we might not want to allow to get through. We can set the thing with, we can instrument the header to be behaving in a way that cross-site, for instance, is actually handled as such and behaves differently to block, for instance, that evil request. And evil request is pretty interesting because over the last couple of years, we've seen a lot of COOP issues called cross-origin opener policy, where fundamentally we, if you look at the screen here, we fundamentally define an opener, like we open a window, we send some messages, we count whatever we want to count, and then we allow the opener itself to open a new window to any victim website. And if we're not actually careful with that, we can interestingly control windows and tabs with Windows Opener. I'm sure if you do a lot of web application scanning, a lot of web application security, you might have seen a lot of the cross-origin opener policy being flagged as such. It's pretty interesting in here because based on the policy you're going to be setting, you might be able to call from a given tab that might be legitimate. You might be able to redirect that user to evil page. What you want to make sure there is that with the cross-origin opener policy, you define what kind of the behavior, like same origin, for instance, the opener should be allowing for. From a given tab, you might be calling another application if and only within the same origin, but you might not want to allow www.google.com to have an opener policy allowing you to go to www.don'tclickmehere.com. Now, what can we also do to do injection defenses? Trusted types is something that actually, as you can imagine in here, we want to solve several types of cross-site scripting, we said. And DOM cross-site scripting is one of the things that makes misbehaving the DOM API pretty interesting because it allows us to fundamentally use control strings, and we need to make sure that those strings, when converted into code, are sanitized. And when you look at it here, for instance, at the given URL, you might be wanting to address that cross-site scripting in the DOM and handle it as such. Now, trusted types is a very good idea. It's been around for a couple of years, actually several years, to be honest with you. And what's relevant for this is that any HTML string, any script string, any URL that you might be triggering get fundamentally typed into three new types: trusted HTML, trusted script, and trusted script URL. And what you get in there is that when you force trusted types, those are fundamentally sanitized, processed, and handled in a more secure way from a DOM perspective. So if we want to address any type of cross-site scripting, like at the DOM level, we can use trusted types to accepting objects in the given way we expect to. You can set up policies, as you can imagine in here, where you create validation rules. You can actually use those policies to create also those objects defined as trusted types. And then you can enforce that policy, setting the content security policy header as such, so that the trusted types are kept along. Now, you might be wondering, how do I get an understanding from a reporting perspective on whether my rollouts of trusted types are actually misbehaving my web application? You can also deploy them with a reporting mode, where you get a lot of information from the trusted types information that we just granted in there. So you all set in reporting mode, for instance, the content security policy. You define as such where you might be requesting trusted types for a TypeScript, for instance. And then we might having actually the DOM to syncing accepting report findings and strings in here, but then we want to make sure that we only accept, for instance, trusted types and handle them as such. If we need to summarize in here how trusted types behave, for instance, you have to simplify security reviews, so you need to dramatically reduce the amount of time spent on code base and handle that code base as such. And then you can implement the trusted types and reporting things as part of your security validation pipelines that you might have established. Now, this is all interesting because fundamentally we all came back to our best friend, that is content security policies. And content security policies, let's think about content security policy level 3, for instance, comes actually with a very big challenge. Now, CSP policies have been around for a while. They are a strong defense in depth mechanism. They're not bulletproof, as we will see in a while, but they are indeed something that do work against trusted scripting. And we can control them with scripts. Scripts can get executed, plugins can be loaded, and it's actually not solving the main problem we're here for, that is escaping or fixing bugs. Now, enabling a content security policy is quite a piece of cake today. I'm pretty sure many of you did that. You can enable that in a reporting only mode. You start collecting CSP reports. You start understanding how your scripts, how all the things and types you are actually loading into your application behave. And then you can, of course, enforce it. Now, the problem is that very easily your web application is going to be looking like this. I'm not a fan of allow lists, and you should be either, because fundamentally allow lists, it's not going to work. Allow list is going to be prone to errors, and allow list is not going to make it in a way that it's maintainable. As you can see in here, it's a mess. I'm sure you spend a lot of time into CSP policies that were bigger probably than your web code base, and CSP policies are fundamentally something we shouldn't be behaving on with an allow list approach. Now, the allow list approach, though, is actually pretty good at blocking third-party JavaScripts, because fundamentally we're going to be defining whatever we want, and we're going to be allowing 1, 2, 300. But then the problem is that it's not maintainable, as we said, and it's not a strong mitigation against trusted scripting, because CDN, because common URLs, because many assets that fundamentally host several type of resources make things pretty interesting. And so my advice in here, of course, I'm pretty sure you know already, is to fundamentally not allow list things and not rely on them for CSP policies. Now, let's have a look at how bypasses are applied over CSP policies. If you look at several of these CSP policies that can be bypassed, you will see that it might be a configuration issue. It might be an allow list problem, like we said. It might also be that we might be enabling a library that fundamentally brings in a lot of attack surface. And it might also be things that don't make that allow list approach maintainable at all. So there are several ways to, and you might have seen also a lot of the bug bounties out there, bypassing a lot of the CSP policies in there. So there is a solution for that. There is a solution for that that is fundamentally, what if instead of handling something that the attacker also can predict, we use actually nonce. And we use nonces that are fundamentally generated by something that is like a random number, random IDs, and the likes, and the attacker itself is not going to be able to inject that ID on their side. It's not going to be able to enforce, I mean, when you actually enforce the nonce part of it, the attacker is not going to be able to inject that, and hence inject the script without a nonce will be fundamentally blocked in the browser. So even if you get an injection without a proper nonce that is set on the server side or the application side, you can see in here that you will not be able to execute that. And that's very actually not bulletproof, but way better than it used to be before. Now, the problem with that is that from a maintenance perspective, actually you might have to do a lot of refactoring and a lot of third-party script widgets and the likes. You might see a lot of violations into your report. And so it has to be done with actually scalability and maintainability in mind. And it's not quite straightforward out there. So we can go the extra mile and we can do strict dynamic in here. So script tags, we might be wanting to cover only scripts. And we might be wanting to make sure that only script tags in response body are actually needing the nonce attribute. Not all scripts, not all the includes that we do in there. So third-party scripts are validated, and also the potentially large refactoring is taken care of. Now, how do I deploy this? First of all, you don't want to actually break your stuff. So you remove all the CSP blockers that you might have. You actually start heading, as we said, the script tags across your CSP nonces into the script tags, and you start there. You can also do the CSP policy in reporting mode. So before turning and flipping the coin on your production application, you start actually light with fundamentally enforcing it in reporting only mode. I need to go a bit faster because we're getting over time. So I'm going to skip a bit of this. I'm going to leave you the deck. But fundamentally, the way this works, removing actually the CSP blockers, is if we do it in a strong way, like inline events like this one are going to be becoming, as you can see the refactoring here, we're going to be covering at the way we load. We do lazy load of JavaScript calls or any type of script request that fundamentally plugs in external URLs, external scripts, or execute codes in there. And when we set it up, we can see how we can have a stronger, it sounds like a Daft Punk song, but we can have actually a very interesting approach into, we set a CSP policy that has strict dynamic but allows unsafe evil. We go for strict dynamic that it is, and then we even remove strict dynamic to the strongest one. But to do that, we need to have a migration path towards actually the CSP policy. And so my advice in here is that start with the reporting mode and get it from there. And now, what's making things even more interesting is that you can use CSP hashes for static HTML. So if any of parts of your site use static HTML, you can actually use those hashes for there. Again, in here, you need to compute and you need to account for the tags in a way that is scalable and probably brought in from your CI/CD pipeline in there. Now, I want to complete the session today with something that is launching at the end of the month. When I first announced that I was making this talk, everybody from Mozilla reached out to me and said, hey, you actually need to make sure that you mention that the Sanitizer API, it's coming live this month. And I think Sanitizer API is pretty cool, to be honest with you. Sanitizer API is fundamentally taking the pain away from you in regards to taking strings of HTML, for instance, and filter out unwanted elements, stripping things, sanitizing HTML entities, and all the likes. And this API, it's actually shipping at the end of the month. It's already available in Mozilla Nightly. It's available in Chrome with the experimental web features enabled. And as you can see in the screenshot in here, all you have to do on the left side is actually what makes things on the right side to be mitigated. The typical, traditional, simplest cross-site scripting that you see on the right side It's fundamentally mitigated by, for the first time also, we have a very simple method that is sat.html that should be quite straightforward to sat and allows that for sanitizing that when you develop, when you make things much simpler in a much secure way to sanitize using that sanitize API. You can make things in a way that, for instance, all the unwanted HTML entities, stripping characters, stripping tags, and the likes can be handled very simple from there. If you have a custom policy, you can also use the sanitizer API and pass a sanitizer config towards it in a way that you can be much more flexible than the traditional normal behavior that you're going to be having. I want to thank you, and I wish you a good day.